I love stories and movies where the good guys win. I would suspect that probably most of you are in the same place. You love stories and movies where the good guys win and where the bad guys or the bad gals lose. Some of my favorite good guy movies, if you're going to put it that way, good guy, bad guy movies, are Robin Hood, where Robin Hood is played by Errol Flynn. Another series that I like is Zorro, played by Guy William. It's actually a Walt Disney series. I like the Superman series. I like murder mysteries because invariably the good guys win. There's a bad guy and somebody goes off and rescues the good guy from whatever the bad guy did. But I have to admit that probably my most enjoyable good guy series is the Zorro series by Guy Williams. And I bought the entire Walt Disney series just to make the point that it really is my favorite. I bought it at a bargain online. Today, if you were to buy it, I found out, I looked it up, it cost you hundreds of dollars to just buy a set. I think I bought it for something like $40, I should say, for all 3 years. And now you'd pay close to $1,000 to get it if you were to buy it. But I love every episode. I probably watched every episode at least 4 times, just to give you an idea as to how much I like the series. And what's always interesting about the series is that there's a commander of the military or somebody who is abusive or oppressive. I mean, almost always. And invariably, somebody is in need, somebody is suffering, somebody is helpless, and there's this bad guy who is winning. And it seems to get worse and worse and worse. And then comes Zorro, known as the Fox. And he shows up, and when the situation's at its absolute worst, he comes in and he rescues the person who's being oppressed. I mean, it's just a really interesting series. And what we're going to find out this morning is that Solomon is going to be talking about oppression in this life. Oppression under the sun. And when he says under the sun, he's talking about the life here on the planet Earth under the sun. He literally means under the sun. And when you go outside, there's a sun. And he's talking about life here. He's not talking about life in heaven. He's talking about the life that you and I live. He's talking about the life that everybody around us lives. Everybody around the world lives. He's talking about your life. He's talking about my life. But once in a while, as we have found in our movies, that there's always a bad movie. There's always a bad movie. And the reason I call it a bad movie is that the oppression gets bad, the suffering gets bad, there's no Superman, there's no Robin Hood, there's no Zorro, there's nobody to come and rescue you or somebody else. And I call that a bad movie because we don't like those kinds of movies. At least I don't like those kinds of movies. I remember on one occasion watching one where it turns out really bad and I felt really depressed for a while. What happens to you when you watch a good guy, bad guy movie and somebody like Superman or Zorro or Robin Hood comes and rescues everybody? Don't you feel good inside? Like, wow, righteousness won, good things happened, the good guy was rescued. But when it goes the other way, you don't feel very good. Well, unfortunately, that is life under the sun. Life under the sun is not always fair. Life under the sun is not always the good guy winning. Life under the sun is the bad guy winning. All too often, the bad guy wins in life under the sun. Our study this morning is about oppression, where the bad guy wins. And what we're going to see this morning is a whole series of examples of oppression and suffering, just to make sure we got the message, we got the point. King Solomon in chapter 1 started off by telling us that life's really bad. He told us that there's no advantage in everything you do. He told us that there's no satisfaction in all of our efforts. We try this and we try that and we try all these different kinds of things. And he said that when you get done, it's emptiness. Everything's vanity and striving after wind. And we've seen that the word for vanity really means empty. And I like the illustration of a soap bubble. The soap bubble has nothing in it, and it doesn't last very long, and that's our life. That's been Solomon's message. That's our life. We saw in chapter 2 that he then explored pleasure to see if there was something valuable in pleasure, something worth living for. He concluded that, yeah, pleasure is really pleasurable. It's fun. It's what you'd like, but it won't do everything for you that you want. So then he looked at wisdom. He saw that wisdom was better than folly, better than foolishness. But even though it's better than foolishness, it's empty as well. And then he went and he looked at work, and he saw that work accomplishes great things, but you can't take it with you. So he concluded that of all the things that he was looking at, is that pleasure is probably the best, but it's kind of empty anyway. That's probably the best way to go, but it's really empty. In chapter 3, then he told us that you plan and you plan and you plan, but God has His plans, and His plans override your plans. You can't always accomplish what you want to accomplish because God is going to let His plans take precedence over your plan. So you might plan, but God's going to interrupt your plan to execute His plan. So you might have great goals. You might want to have a job here, or you might want to do something over here, or you might want to have some long-range vision as to what it is you're trying to accomplish. Maybe you're wanting to get married. I mean, I don't know what your plan might be, but God has His plan for your life, and it's going to be the one that's going to actually occur in your life. So Solomon's been looking at one thing after another in our life, and he keeps coming up with, there's nothing left but just to live for pleasure, but there's emptiness and pleasure. And so the message really is that life's really bad. And so now in chapter 4, he's going to look at oppression. He's going to continue looking at his theme, and that is that life is bad, is his message. So our passage this morning is Ecclesiastes 4, and it's verse 1 is where we're going to start. And we're going to look at 5 illustrations of oppression in our study this morning. Actually, there are 6 in chapter 4 of Ecclesiastes. And the last one deals with unhappy people and leaders who are oppressed by their people. But this morning, we're going to not look at that one. We're going to look at the first 5, that's verses 1 through 12. So let's look at the first illustration of oppression. And you're going to see that this illustration of oppression is oppressed by oppressors. Now, when we think of oppression, we think of somebody doing something to us that's really negative. That's his first illustration. So let's read it. Verse 1 says, "And then I looked at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, and they had no one to comfort them." Now, he starts off by saying he looked. He says, "I looked." The word for looked in the Hebrew is somewhat simple. It just means to look or to inspect. That's the basic idea. And you say, well, he says he looked again. Yes, he's referring back to chapter 3, verse 16, because in verse 16 he says, "Therefore I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness." So he made the point that there should be justice, and there's not, there's wickedness. And the message is that it's not right, just all backwards. So he says, "I looked again." And the word for looked is in the imperfect tense in the Hebrew, and it just means that he was looking and looking and looking and checking, and he's come up with some examples. He's come up with different examples, 6 of them in the chapter. We're going to look at 5. And so he looks at different acts of oppression, and he gives us the first one in this verse. And the first one he looks at is somebody who's crying. He says, "I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they had nobody to comfort them." Now, I think we understand that. I think we identify with a situation where somebody is oppressed, and as a result, they are crying. They're struggling in what's happening in their life. I mean, I think we all understand that one. There's lots of different examples in life. I think one of the examples that comes to my mind right away when I think about Tears of the Oppressed is something that's really common in our culture, common in our church. When people get divorces. When people get divorced, there's lots of tears. Tears on both sides. And in some cases, it's really unfair. Sometimes I refer to the guilty and the innocent. And sometimes that's probably a good definition. That's not always true. But he says, I saw the tears of the oppressed and that there was no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power. Now, isn't that interesting the way he puts that? He says the oppressors have power. And then he adds this interesting statement. He says, and there's no one to comfort them either. So there's nobody to comfort the one who's oppressed, and there's nobody to comfort the oppressor, implying that the oppressor is doing what they're doing because they are struggling themselves. So you have the oppressed and the oppressors who aren't comforted, and that's the reason that this happens. I want to give you some examples, make you think about this, think about what he's talking about. Here's a first example. How about women being gang raped? That's been pretty common this last year, especially in Europe, as we have a group of immigrants moving into different countries who aren't used to the laws and the way the culture works. And so there have been women who have been gang raped, and it gets broadcast even on the internet. I mean, it's really horrible what's going on. There's a woman who is in tears. She's oppressed by a bunch of oppressors. That's a pretty live one. Or how about ISIS? ISIS has been known for the last number of years for torturing different individuals. They behead people. They have even been torturing children. I read that just recently. They're noted for their sex slaves. They burn people alive. They have even crucified people. I mean, they are big time into oppression and causing people to suffer. That's verse 1. People cry. The oppressors have power. ISIS clearly has power. They can do whatever they want to the people that they have. They capture them. They control them. They can do whatever they want. Recently, the last couple of weeks, a teenager torched a man who was sleeping. Guy was asleep. He lit him on fire and then stood there and laughed at the man while he was burning. Guy woke up realizing he was on fire. Man ended up with second-degree burns. We're thankful that he did not die. Or how about a government that ignores our laws? I mean, we have laws in place, and Congress is supposed to obey, and the president's supposed to obey, and the judiciary is supposed to obey, and all of them are supposed to make the laws, enforce the laws, and we find in the last number of years that that's not been true. If I don't like the law, I don't have to enforce it, and if I don't like the law, I can make another law, and I'll do it on my own, independent of the legislature. I mean, that's abuse. And what recourse do we as citizens have? We have none. Now, that's power. Oppressors have power. And there are people who suffer as a result. Or how about dishonest contractors? Make it a little bit more personal, a little bit closer to home. I'm sure we've all hired a contractor to do something in your house, do something for you. They had their own standard about how to do it, and they didn't do it right, or they didn't do it at all, and they took your money and walked off, and you were left without the money and without the work being completed. We had that happen here at the church. I mean, that's oppression. I mean, they had the power. They had the power, they had the ability to complete it, and they chose not to do that. And then you end up with a major problem trying to get your money back or trying to get the job done. Or how about people who are oppressed by gossiping? That's a real live issue. Happens in the church, happens in the home, happens in a neighborhood, happens in politics, in the country, in the state, in the city. We see it most in groups like a church setting. Somebody gets upset with somebody else or they misunderstand somebody and they don't want to go and talk to the person to find out if maybe they misunderstood what happened. They just want to talk about it. Because maybe they got hurt. What they're really more interested in doing is somehow comforting themselves and destroying another person in the process. That's power. The gossipers got real power. and they oppress somebody. So King Solomon starts off in verse 1 with an example of oppression that we understand. There's an oppressor with power, and somebody gets oppressed and they cry. The implication is they really suffer. That's his example. And what can you do about it? The message is they have power, you can't. So you suffer. Verse 2. So he says in verse 2 that, hey, there's something better. He says, I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. His point is that it's better to be dead than to go through the experience of being oppressed and crying. He says, look at the world. The world's just one oppression after another oppression after another. And it'd be better to be dead than to live through all of that. And then he says in verse 3, there's something even better than being dead, never being born. I mean, forget the idea of living and then dying. He says, how about just not ever having come into life, never coming into the world? He says, but better off than both of them is the one who's never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that's done under the sun. So his message is, it'd be better if you weren't even born than to go through this horrible life. That's his idea. It's a horrible life. Life of oppression. The oppressive life that we live here on this earth under the sun. Verse 4 gives us another example, his second illustration. This one is an illustration of oppression due to envy or competition. I mean, I think I like the phrase competition. Some of your Bibles will say envy. Some of your Bibles will say rivalry. It's all pretty close to the same idea. The Hebrew word that's translated as rivalry can mean jealousy. It can mean rivalry. It can mean zeal and competition. So it's a blur of all this together. So somebody who's motivated and motivated against other people. So maybe it's competition or it's rivalry or it's zeal, but it's interpersonal competition, as you'll see. Let's read the verse. And I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is a result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after wind. So he says, everything that goes on in life, there's always this tension between you and other people. There's always some conflict going on between you and other people. Here he says it's rivalry, competition, envy. It's a kind of a squishy word. It has lots of shades of meaning. So the basic idea is that there's a tension in some way, shape, or form between you and your neighbor. Now you say, like, who's my neighbor? How about the workplace? What happens at work? Have you ever had competition at work? Have you ever been fired at work because somebody had a complaint about you and you weren't able to defend yourself? Maybe there was interpersonal conflict between you and somebody else at work. And that person got to your boss. And your boss happened to listen to that person. And you weren't influential, but your colleague, your fellow employee, person you've been working with, was able to get rid of you. Has that ever happened to you? I remember working at Raytheon. I've been an aerospace engineer. I survived 4 layoffs during my career. 4 different times we downsized the company because they didn't get certain government contracts to keep everybody employed. I learned very quickly in the first layoff cycle that the people who got laid off were the people who produced the least or who produced less. I found out really quick that the way you kept your job is you produced more than everybody else, at least you tried. If you wanted to keep your job, you worked hard and you tried to please your boss, or otherwise when it came around to the next layoff cycle, and I didn't know there was going to be 4, but there were 4 in the end. If you weren't one of the top performers, then you wouldn't be guaranteed to have a job next cycle. I mean, talk about competition in the workplace. I mean, who was I competing against? All the other employees in my department. Because if I didn't produce more than they did, I might be laid off, right? He says, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is a result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. Some Bibles say envy, some Bibles say competition. Whatever it is, it's between you and somebody else. Or how about this one? How about a promotion? Promotions work the same way, right? Who will get the next major promotion? The better performer, typically. The one who showed wisdom, the one who pleased their boss the most. Maybe that's not always the case. Maybe the boss just has a friendship with somebody. Maybe something's unfair, but in principle, that's usually the way it works. Or how about competition in the church? Someone has been asked to serve as a deacon or a deaconess or an elder, and they serve. And is there somebody else in the church thinking that maybe they should have been asked to be a deacon? Is there somebody in the church thinking that maybe they should have been asked to be a deaconess? Maybe there's somebody who's thinking, well, I should have been asked to be an elder. I do more than that person. I'm better than that person. I'm nicer than that person. I don't know what you want to add and fill in the blank, but you get the idea. That happens in churches. It happened with me, actually, many years ago. I remember people being asked to be an elder in a church, and I remember that I thought I should have been an elder. I've told the story before about myself. God had to humble me and help me understand that it wasn't His time for me to be an elder. I just said it correctly. Or how about rivalry in the home? You say, like, how does rivalry show up in the home? Oh, how about mom likes my brother more than me? Mom likes my sister more than me. Or maybe his dad likes me more than somebody else in the family. Has that happened in your home where there's sibling rivalry? One parent likes a child better than another child, and what does he say? I've seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his brother, and so you're competing with somebody. There's lots of examples of this in life. But you know what happens? We just don't stop to think about it. And what Solomon did, he says, I looked and I searched and I thought, and he's given us some examples. He's not given us all the examples here. He's just given us some. Verse 5 and 6 gives us another example of oppression. This is the oppression due to foolishness. This person, we're told, is the fool. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. One handful of rest is better than two fists full of labor striving after wind. Now, I want you to notice what he does. In verse 5, it's the person who is basically a lazy person. Person who is lazy. And verse 6 is the example of somebody who's working really hard. Okay, so you have the example of someone who's lazy and someone who is working really hard. And guess who the person is that's lazy. Proverbs would call them a sluggard. Here in verse 5, they're called a fool. And we've seen that a sluggard actually is a subcategory of a fool, just another kind of fool. So the fool is one who's lazy. The fool is always interested in pleasure, always interested in fun. They don't want to work. They just would like to have somebody else do it. And that's the picture of verse 5 and 6. And verse 6 is the guy who works hard. And then he says at the end of verse 6, he says, it's striving after wind. He says, that's empty. He's already made the point earlier that being able to just enjoy pleasure is the best. But in reality, if you don't work, then you don't have anything to eat, and you have a major problem. So the message is, that's not wise, so you have to work. That's why the lazy person is called a fool, because the fool isn't taking care of themselves, isn't taking care of their basic needs. They're just a fool. And yet he says that being able to just kick back and do nothing is probably the best in life, but you're stupid if you do that, or you're a fool if you do that. You can't really do that. You're just foolish at that point. In Proverbs 6:6, we were with the men yesterday morning, and we were talking about the sluggard, and we crossed this passage. Let me just read it to you. Good illustration of this person. Go to the ant, O sluggard, observe her ways and be wise. Which, having no chief, officer, or ruler, prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provision in the harvest? How long will you lie down, O sluggard? The idea is that they're lying down. It's just, you know, kick back, you know, just going to have fun. Don't want to work, that's too much of a pain. When will you rise up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, your poverty will come in like a vagabond, and your need like an armed man. Message is, your need's coming and you can't stop him because, why? He's an armed man, he's got a gun. Can't stop it. So if you're going to be a fool and just live for pleasure, just live for fun, kick back, do nothing, you're going to pay the price. You're a fool. You're going to have a need. In verse 6, he says, so it'd be better to work, right? But that's empty too. So it's the oppression of the foolish. The fool, the sluggard, oppresses themselves. They end up in a situation that they really don't want to have, but they're too lazy to do anything about it. So it's another example of oppression. Verse 7. Verse 7, he says, and I looked again at vanity under the sun. So he's now going to look at another really vain thing. And this time it's oppression due to greed. And this is the opposite of the sluggard. And there was a certain man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother, and yet there was no end to all of his labor. So the message is, here's a man who, he doesn't have a son or a brother, and yet he works. He works and he works and he works and he works and he works. He says, indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? Notice the theme of pleasure in this passage. The message is, we all want to live for pleasure. We want to be able to go home, eat a good meal, do something that's enjoyable before we go to bed. We want to get up the next morning, do something that's fun. His message is, pleasure is what we live for. But here he says, there's this man who doesn't have any children. And what's he doing? He's working really hard to get rich. Why? Pleasure? No, he's working really hard. What's his conclusion at the end of the verse? This too is vanity or empty, and it's a grievous task. So this is oppression due to greed. The man's oppressing himself. Working really hard, oppressing himself. The fifth example of oppression is the oppression of the loner. I was wondering, why did he do this? In verse 8, he's actually talking about a man who's a loner. He has no children. But he works, 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 works. And now in verses 9, 10, 11, and 12, he talks about a loner. And he makes the point that it's not smart to be a loner. If you're a loner, it's not good. He says, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. And the message is that you are more productive if you work as a team with somebody else. I think most husbands and wives have found out that when you work together, it's really beneficial. You get a lot accomplished. Whereas if you were by yourself, there's limitations. So in verse 10, he gives us another example. He says, for if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. So the message is, there is a time when the crisis comes and the loner needs help. In verse 11, he talks about the loner needs help in order to be warm. And I think most of us would identify with that. I'm not sure that's a solution most of us would sign up for, though. It says, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? We understand the concept. If you're cold and you hug one another, you sleep together, say in the same sleeping bag or something, we understand that you'd be warmer. That makes sense. So he's talking about the oppression of being alone. When you're all by yourself, there are limitations. I've often thought about my mother. She lived at home in her latter years, but she had me. She could pick up the phone. What happens when you have no children? What happens when you're truly alone? I mean, that's oppression, oppression of being alone. Verse 12, and if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. So now he talks about the fact that a loner needs help to be protected. So some people have security alarms, but his solution here is that it's better if there's two. It's even better if there's three. That way you have protection. So what's he done? What he's done here is he's given us one example after another of oppression that we don't often stop to think about. Someone once said that life would be great if it wasn't for people. But did you realize that most oppression comes as a result of people? Most oppression is a result of people. I remember in my 20s thinking that I would like to have a job where I could work without having anybody around me. That would be my ideal job, be able to have a job where I didn't have to interface with anybody, talk with anybody, have anything to do with anybody. I don't feel that way today, but that was in my 20s. I just thought that would be the ideal job, being able to work would not have to interact with people. Well, oppression under the sun. You know what? We don't stop to think about it. But did you know that life's oppressive? It is. Life's oppressive. So what do we do? What's the solution? Well, let me give you some things to think about. First of all, what we've already seen in this chapter is that it's not good to be a fool. You do not want to be a sluggard. So let's put on our list the first thing that we need to do is to be wise. That's the first thing we want to make sure that we are, is to be wise so we know how to live. James chapter 1, verse 5 tells us we can ask for wisdom. One of the problems of a sluggard is that they're not wise. The reason that they're a sluggard, Proverbs tells us, is that they are not wise. That's the core problem to a sluggard. They're not wise. And you can say, oh, they're a sluggard. They're not working. They're lazy. That's the real problem. No, lacks wisdom. That's why they're willing to be lazy. Wisdom says, go out and work. The problem of a sluggard is that they lack wisdom. So the first thing to do is to be wise and to work. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 6 to 11. The next thing is that when you work, seek to serve the Lord. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 5 and 6 is fabulous. Just listen. Don't need to turn there. Just listen. Here's what it says. Slaves, be obedient to those who are your masters. How about changing it? Employee to employer, according to the flesh with fear and trembling and sincerity of your heart as to Christ. So talking about employees, so that you serve not by way of eye service as to men, but as slaves of Christ doing the will of God from the heart. So the message is that if you're an employee, then when you go to work, who do you work for? You say, well, I work for my boss, my earthly supervisor. Yes, that's true, but what Ephesians chapter 6, verses 5 and 6 says, your real employer is who? God. That's who your true employer is. In fact, when I used to work down at Raytheon, I used to make the comment that my real employer was God. Not my supervisor, not the company. My real employer was God. That's who I was really serving. That's who I was really, truly working for. Third, be a team member and not a loner, because that's the message of the chapter, right? One of the messages of the chapter is that you're more productive if you work as a team member. And here in the church, I've made the comment on a number of times that I like working as a team. I like to be a team member, not a loner. In fact, when I feel like I'm alone, I get discouraged. That ever happened to you? You feel like you're all alone in something you're doing, you get a little discouraged. And I get discouraged when I get the sense that maybe I'm out there all by myself. It gets a little discouraging at times. Fourth point to think about is remember that oppression is due to sin. So you say, like, why does the oppression exist? Because of sin. Because we have evil people. We have wicked people, people who are sinners like you and I. Only some of them are not Christians, and so some of them are given to sin, to being really, truly wicked. Then there's another section called God Allows Suffering. And you say, like, why does God allow all of this? So you explain that the reason oppression occurs is because of sin. Why does God allow it? That's our study for next time. All right, let's pray.